Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This episode is sponsored by H&M. This back-to-school season, H&M and the Marsha P. Johnson Institute have partnered to support and celebrate LGBTQ plus youth and the beauty inherent within our varied gender identities. Today, Liz will speak with Elle Moxley, founder of MPJI.
Hey, Mama, welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy, the co-founder of Motherly, and I am a mother of four myself. Today, we're bringing a special episode with an expert, and we will be doing that from time to time, bringing in guests who can help us learn how to thrive as modern mothers. And today's conversation is all about what we can do on a day-to-day basis to build a more inclusive society for our kids and for all members of this upcoming generation. And that's why I'm thrilled to have Elle Moxley with us today. Elle is an artist, community organizer, speaker, writer, executive director, and founder of the Marsha P. Johnson Institute, which advocates for Black trans people, and co-founding member and former strategic partner of the Black Lives Matter Network. We are honored to have Elle with us and hear her story and learn more from her directly about her deep passion and how parents can help build that more inclusive society that we all want. Elle Moxley, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a really special episode, and it is all about what we can do as parents to build a more inclusive society for all, but especially for our children. I think parenthood can really motivate us to do that kind of work. And you have been at the forefront of many human rights movements and campaigns, including through the leadership role that you played in the Black Lives Matter movement and also the trans rights movement. So for those listeners who are not familiar with your story, and it's really an amazing story, what can you share about how you got into this kind of work?
What I can share how I got into this kind of work was really my own need to survive. I had no intentions on becoming a leader or someone that was recognizable. It was mostly about my own survival. I knew that I was good at some things, but I knew more importantly that I went without a lot of things. I went without housing and jobs, and I went without support and love for my own family. And that led me to wanting to be a voice for others so that others never had to experience what I did. And that's what's been the driving force for all of the work that I've done, is just wanting to really interrupt anyone having those kind of really difficult, dangerous, unfortunate realities to be a part of their lives and their legacies. And so my survival led me to activism, and activism led me to my calling and has opened, and I trust will continue to open many doors for me.
When you were growing up, I know you grew up in Columbus, Ohio. Did you ever envision yourself as an activist in that sense?
No, I envisioned myself as a Grammy Award winning singer, and that's what I wanted to do. That was my passion. That was my drive. I always knew that I was creative. I didn't think that I would have to be creative as it related to advocating for my life and others. And so I'm grateful that I took all of my talents and put them into advocacy.
Were there some key milestones or turning points for you in that journey of knowing who you were, being so open about who you are, and then becoming an activist on multiple fronts?
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of turning points. I think anytime you are homeless, there's a turning point that some, unfortunately, are not able to recover from. And so at the brink of a turning point in my life, I was homeless and didn't know if that would be the reality for the rest of my life or not. I knew I deeply didn't desire that. But then another turning point happened where I went to jail. And so these two very difficult things happened to me that I never imagined would happen to me. So it kind of opened up my mind to what can I do so this never happens again? Mm-hmm. And I knew that some of the things I was experiencing were unjust. I just didn't know how to advocate for myself, and I didn't know that was an option. And so being homeless and being in jail, certainly you learn really quick how to speak up for yourself, but also to take ownership of who you are. And taking ownership of my own womanhood really was the turning point that changed for the better in my life, and I think certainly changed the world, to be quite honest.
I completely agree. I mean, one of the things that you've done with that mission is launched the Marsha P. Johnson Institute. So for those listeners who are not aware, I know you're such a promoter of her story. Who was Marsha and why did you name the institute after her?
Marsha P. Johnson was someone who clearly has lived forever and will continue to live forever as long as I have anything to say about it. Just the contributions that she was able to make to the gay liberation movement as an activist, but also as a Black person. Those are things that have been leading the way long before we knew they would be influential or a reference point for the generation of today. And so she was an artist. She was an activist. She was a sex worker. She was a drag queen. She was all of the things that during the 1960s and 1970s were not celebrated, were not applauded, were not very fetch, but she made her life her own. And that's part of the reason why we named the Marsha P. Johnson Institute after her. I wanted to pay homage to someone who came before me whose steps I knew I was walking in as I was building the Black Lives Matter movement. And so that's really what shaped into the Marsha P. Johnson Institute was all of the work that predated me and also wanting to make sure that the work that I was doing, that it had a place to live that wasn't separate from all of the movement history that existed in the world.
Where were you on your personal journey when you got involved in co-founding the Black Lives Matter Network? Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Absolutely. I was 3 months removed from jail in homelessness. And so when I was contributing to that movement, it wasn't just about the unjust murders of Black cisgender men. It was also about my own experience that I had recovered and was transitioning out of as a Black transgender woman. And so being in a place where I was constantly fearful of my death in many reasons, in many ways, whether it was the police or a lover being at the hands or the crux of my potential demise, is where I was. You know, those were the conditions that I was in and out of every single day. And so my advocacy was not being informed by the potential of fame. I'll just say that. It was being really informed and influenced by what I was afraid of. And death was certainly something that was at the tipping point of where I was and really wanting to run as far away from death as I possibly could because, you know, I felt like the next headline would be me because I knew what I was doing to stay afloat. I knew what I was forced to do to try to make a way for myself. So, yeah, you know, that time I don't reflect on often. It's probably why I've been so successful. Even taking that bit of a pause for me is a moment that I don't really like to take just because I was in a really painful place in my own personal life. And so when this very large thing was happening, it was a lot of pain on top of pain. But, you know, one of the beautiful things about the Marsha P. Johnson Institute is that we get to shift and we get to create more opportunities for joy because we don't have to always live in the sorrow and we don't always get to live in the joy. And I always want to create a space in which I'm able to do both, but also to dream about what's possible in the future.
Well, tell us about the mission of the Marsha P. Johnson Institute. What kind of work are you doing and what are your supporters getting behind?
Well, the Marsha P. Johnson Institute is an organization that works to protect and defend the human rights of Black transgender people in the United States. And so our work in protecting and defending the community means that we're always looking to be a bridge to provide resources directly in the hands of the community, which is why we've been really operating our COVID recovery program for the last 2 years, just really wanting to make sure that our community has been directly supported with monetary resources during this crisis, but also continuing to build a bridge in which we can hear what our community wants and what our community needs, and always being very clear that we're not, you know, a savior, that we can't do everything, but we can do what we can and we can offer to do more. And that's what our commitment has always been. And those who support us have always made that commitment as well. Today's partnership with H&M, I think, reflects the reality of what happens when those who believe in something can come together and create an opportunity for those whose lives are in jeopardy in different ways so that they can benefit. And that's the work that we try to do. It's the work that we try to encourage. And it is the support that we try to receive so that we can continue to do the work that we set out to do.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the initiative with H&M?
The initiative with H&M is one that I'm really excited about. Honored to have had this vision and to have shared this vision with H&M so that it could actually come to life. I wanted to make sure that experiences I had as a young customer of H&M, just searching, trying to figure out what could I wear there that would affirm my identity, but not necessarily having the guidance, that we would be able to provide some guidance for those who needed it and wanted it, especially, you know, it's been a hard year. You know, a lot of young people have not actually had an opportunity to go to school, have not had an opportunity to be in community with each other. And so today's event was for the benefit of youth ages 14 to 24 to have an opportunity to not only build with each other and to shop and to receive free makeovers and free clothing from H&M, but to also partake in a wonderful conversation between myself and Emmy-nominated actress MJ Rodriguez, Michaela J. And so it was just a beautiful initiative. And one of the beautiful things about the relationship with H&M is that it's not just a one-stop shop. We are so committed to continuing to find more ways to bring more opportunities and resources to Black trans people and Black trans youth.
In some ways, this kind of event was unimaginable, certainly when I was growing up. What would it have meant to you to see an event like that? Maybe you might not have been able to get there, but you saw it on social media. What would it have meant to you growing up when you were a teenager to see that, to be a part of that?
No, I love this question, Liz, because it's a question that I ask myself all day today. You know, what kind of impact would this have had on me? I know what kind of impact I've had on the world because of my sorrow. But I don't know what kind of impact I would have had on the world if I had more opportunities for joy as a 12 and 13 and 14 year old, to be affirmed in the budding understanding of who I would be as a woman. If that was supported early on, I mean, the sky really was probably the limit and has always been the limit, but I probably would be that Grammy award winning singer, probably, you know, I think that would have really been life-changing. And so I hope that, you know, this event was life-changing for somebody today.
So many parents today, you know, we grew up in one world and we are raising our children hoping to create a different kind of world, a more inclusive world for them. But we need resources to do that, right? We weren't taught by our parents' generation how to do that.
Don't I know it?
Yeah. So for parents who want to have really honest conversations with their children about topics that you think about every day that you live, race, sexuality, intersectionality, what advice do you have for them?
To listen. A lot of times parents go into conversations with their minds made up around what the end outcome should be and with an assumption made that children, young people, young adults have no knowledge of race or class or gender. And I think that's a falsity of parents' own ignorance and what they are unwilling to face. the beautiful thing about children is that they face everything in the most honest and tender ways. And sometimes we interrupt them so that we can still be the dominant force in their lives and in their minds. But children, young people have always had more ideas about the possibilities than a little bit. And so I think that's the one thing that people have to do is to listen. I think about my own relationship with my mother in particular. And I think one of the things that certainly didn't exist for her was a rubric on how to raise a young Black trans girl. It didn't exist for me. And so I do wish that we would have been able to go on that journey together, but I was forced to go on it alone. And, you know, I think when you, as a parent, have not been on a journey with your child, the only thing that you can do as a way to provide some recourse or some correction is to just listen about what that experience was like. Because one thing that children are very aware of is the experience that our parents have had. We know if our parents have been divorced. We know if our parents have lost a job. We know if our parents have battled an illness. And we've watched and seen how that has not only physically, but emotionally shown up in their experiences. What doesn't always happen is parents reaching back or reaching out to say, what has this experience done to my baby? And so when we're able to start having those conversations where parents listen, I do think that there'll be a shift culturally around the sustainability of not only the relationships between loved ones, but more opportunities for loving relationships will exist across race, class, and gender. But we're just not having enough conversations where the young people are leading and being heard and respected for what they know.
That is such a powerful point about listening, that children know and they need to feel safe enough to be able to say who they are, what they're seeing in the world. I mean, sometimes even my own kids will say things that make me feel uncomfortable because, as you said, they're just brutally honest about the world as they experience it. And we need to make them feel safe to share their feelings, experiences, identities.
The world is brutally honest with them, which is the only reason why they're brutally honest. And so that's something that we have to make more space for, is how do we acknowledge the honesty that doesn't exist in us?
As additive, perhaps, to the listening, I'm wondering about the conversation starting. For example, in my own family, I have tried, since my kids are really young, just to talk about sex and sexuality in a non-stigmatized way, in a non-hushed way. So I kind of force myself to start conversations at weird times, like when we're in the car or when they're in the bath, because they can't really go anywhere. So I'm going to have a casual conversation about this.
It's never casual. It's never casual to the kids. It's always like, what the hell is my mom saying?
I'm trying to keep it casual because my insides are kind of like, right, you know, on a roller coaster. But I want to make it feel not like a secret topic, it's not, or something that they, yes, can't talk to me about. But I guess, exactly, I'm wondering about the conversations that we need to start about gender, sexuality, race, class with our children. Do you have any guidance on how to start an open and honest conversation if these topics are just not coming up inside your home organically?
I think for me, in my own personal life with my nieces and nephews, I just try to acknowledge what we know exists. And that's why I say it's always awkward when someone that you don't want to have sex with is talking to you about sex. And no one wants to think about sex as it relates to their parent.
For sure.
We don't want to think about our parents being sexually active, and we don't want our parents to think about us being sexually active, because there's a negative connotation there. And so I do think like that starts very early on with just being honest about gender and being very clear and firm that genders are broad. There are not just two genders, that you don't have to just have sex with someone whose gender is the opposite of yours. That's not what we expect as a family. And continuing to reiterate that, I think, is a way to engage. I think anytime that you are having a binary conversation about gender or sex or race, the world is going to teach your child that other things exist. And based on how you having engaged them and introduced them to those topics, they will either receive it or reject it. And, you know, I think we have enough bigotry in this country and enough naiveness that is perpetuated as a cultural belief or religious base that actually is much more rooted in our own shame around our desires. So I think being more open about the desires that parents have had, that they will have, and that they will continue to have, I think that's an honest conversation that kids need to see modeled, as opposed to interrogated about as it relates to their interests. Because for me, I was forced into a situation where I had to acknowledge something I knew no knowledge about. I had no idea what it was to be gay, but it was something that was labeled on me. And so I assumed, based on how I saw myself in comparison to other kids, that's who I was. But I didn't know what that meant. And there was no one to say this is what it meant. But I was interrogated to the point where I just said, okay, I'm gay. And years later, it's like, oh, no, you were just trans. You know, but having the opportunity to explore what that meant for me would have been eye-opening. And it probably wouldn't have been such a violent journey along the way.
What about the parents who say things like, oh, I teach my kids not to see race. We don't see race here.
That's stupid.
What would you say to them? Why do you say that?
There's not one person on the face of the earth who does not see race. So it's like some Jedi mind trick to say, oh, we teach them not to see race. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Just to be quite frank, I'm like, there's no eloquent answer here for any of this. Mm-hmm. Like, that's stupid. There's no way that you can look at me and say, oh, I'm teaching my kid to not think about you as a race. I am a Black woman. I am chocolate and I show up and all of that everywhere I go. You are a white woman, you know? And so I'm not teaching my kids to not see any race. That doesn't even make sense based on visually what we're experiencing. If you have the privilege to see, you see race. Mm-hmm. And you see it in your mind before you actually see it with your eyes. Mm-hmm. So you've already created an idea around someone's identity based on your perception of their skin color. And so this idea that we don't teach people race and we don't teach our kids race is actually just something that we say to be politically correct. And you will never hear that said from any person of color. There's a particular privilege and experience that is associated with being able to say such a thing that I don't think white people are ever thoughtful about when they engage people of color.
What is a better way for those listeners who didn't even realize that they were maybe not acknowledging the lived experience of Black people? What's a better way to talk about what I hope is underneath that sentiment, which is we see everyone as equal?
From my experience, I'm rooted in the truth. And so fortunately for me, I had a mother who instilled in me the history of Black people in America, the history of enslaved African people across the world. And so that was the way that I was raised. But it was something about the ancestry of my own experience that was very important for me to understand what was going to happen to me in the world. And I think the same should be taught to others, because there is privilege that exists around the complicitness of forgetting history and erasing history. And so I think there is a responsibility for those who abide by the I don't see race to acknowledge it in a way that moves it beyond we're all equal, because that's just not the experience we've had. There were over 500 years of colonization that interrupted an entire world's opportunity to create the equity that we like to believe does exist. So I would always suggest that people root their experiences not only in love, but in truth. And the only way that there will ever be any conversations honestly had about race, class, and gender is if it is one that is rooted in what has happened to people across race, class, and gender over time. And that doesn't happen enough, which is why people can deny that race even exists.
I want to speak directly to the parents who are raising children who identify outside the gender binary. We know that Gen Z is possibly the most gender fluid generation ever.
Gender free.
I love that. I have several friends who are navigating this with their own children. What advice can you give both to those parents who are raising a child who is not gender binary? And also, what advice do you have for those who want to wrap them in support?
I would definitely tell them to find a community organization. I just came actually from a visit to Indiana where it was an amazing local organization that did not have any funding, that literally was a parent support group for parents whose children are trans. And it was one of the most touching experiences I've ever had to see their commitment and their willingness to learn while being very honest about the struggles and wanting to support other parents who may be struggling and who may be resistant. All of us need community, children included. And so I think it's so important to surround yourself with people who are having experiences similar so that you don't feel alone and that you don't get resentful for not having the answers, because the resentment leads to even more devastation when you're trying to support your child who's already devastated by being different. And so that's the thing that I would always say is seek community, find resources that will encourage more opportunities for knowledge as opposed to opportunities for you to resist the essence of who your child is.
You alluded to Gen Z as Gen Free, which is beautiful. What makes you hopeful for our future, for the future of your community and this next generation of kids that we're raising?
Oh my goodness, it's the young people. So hopeful for the young people to have new realities that I and so many in my age group just did not have. There's a 19-year difference between me and my mother. And while we had very similar experiences, our experiences were very wide and few. And so I'm just excited that the experiences young people have are their own. I think there's a wide enough gap culturally now where the experiences are so far that the youth are leading us in a way that we don't even know we're being led. So I'm excited to be led. Mm. I'm a bit exhausted. So I'm excited for others to have the answers. But I'm also excited about what I saw today. Seeing people, families, children, young adults, their community members, people they work with, being empowered together. And that's something that I'm really excited about is joy and love and the beauty of Black trans people being celebrated so that everybody can still also celebrate themselves by celebrating this wonderful community.
You mentioned that you're exhausted.
Yes.
And after hearing all of what you've been through and what you've built, I can only imagine. And on the Instagram account for MPJI, you recently posted, "We believe that rest and relaxation are revolutionary for Black trans people." So I'm curious if you can kind of explain what you mean by that and also give some practical guidance about how those of us who are allies can step up and take the burden away from the people who most need to be freed from all the pressures that are on them.
For the Black trans community, we spend all of our days educating people on race, class, and gender. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people don't know, that by assuming that we will present or be super magical beings of the world, it is an exhaustive request that we're constantly navigating and negotiating, not only externally, but internally, as we are constantly finding out who we all are. And so for Black trans people to take rest means that we are providing access to something that's never been given to us, which is what makes it revolutionary. We're not waiting for permission to take rest, and we're not waiting for permission to take action. One of the things that I'm always reflective of is that I've had to be so mad to be able to create the Marsha P. Johnson Institute. Now that I've created the Marsha P. Johnson Institute, I don't have to stay mad. But I do have to provide myself with something that I haven't been able to get, which is some rest. And so practical things really just mean that, like, it is okay to rest. Mm-hmm. And finding more spaces for myself is something that I'm trying to model so that not only the staff of the Marsha P. Johnson Institute can model it for themselves, but that others who watch and follow and are influenced by us can do the same, because we all are working overtime. Some of us are actually working triple, quadruple time, and we need to ease up on those expectations, especially as it relates to Black trans people and this new phenomenon around social justice. This new phenomenon around social justice is one that has become highly popular to align yourself with a movement or a hashtag without doing any intentional work to undo the reasons why we need hashtags and movements.
Any final ask, I guess, of our listeners who have heard your story and know more about the impact of your work and the people that you serve, what do you need from the rest of us?
I don't want to say I need. What I would say is that if those who have listened and hear not only my story, but the story of the work of the Marsha P. Johnson Institute, I would say visit MarshaP.org and support our work, make a donation. Visit our website for more information about resources and organizations that are doing work across the country. We're very honored to uplift those organizations locally and nationally that are contributing to making this world very, very different for so many in our community.
Well, Elle Moxley, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us today to share all your expert and hard-won wisdom on the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you so much, Liz, for having me. It's truly been a pleasure, and hopefully we'll see you in the Midwest sometime soon.
H&M and MPJI advocate for full equality for transgender and non-binary people. For more resources, please visit MarshaP.org. That's MarshaP.org.
Well, that's it for our show this week. Elle, thank you for joining us and for sharing your wisdom. And thanks to our listeners for tuning into our podcast this season. Next week, we have Emily Oster, the data and parenting guru. She is returning to our podcast to talk about her new book, as well as what parents should be thinking about as they head back to school this year amidst COVID news and Delta. I know you're going to want to tune in. And as always, we would love it if you spread the word about the Motherly Podcast. So if you can, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Leaving a review seriously takes about 30 seconds, but it really helps other people discover our show. And I really love reading your feedback. I truly read every single one. The Motherly Podcast is produced by Jennifer Bassett with editing from Seaplane Armada. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.